Hello and welcome to this talk on Chaoszone TV or TV. Here on the RC3 2020. This talk will be about FPGAs, field programmable gate arrays, and it will be given by Pepin DeVos, about his experience in documenting the GoWin FPGAs. Have a lots of fun and enjoy the talk.
Hello everyone, I will be giving a presentation about how to fuzz an FPGA, but the short answer is it depends. So I will be mostly talking about my particular experience and hopefully someone gets something interesting out of it and try to apply it to their own interests, whether that is contributing to this particular project or starting their own or contributing to another one. I'm Pepijn DeVos. I'm a software developer and IC designer. And my mission is to make better open source software for chip designers. Here's my website and the link to the project, what I will be mostly talking about, which is about reverse engineering the software of the GoWin FPGAs. Yeah, and I've also linked my Patreon and GitHub sponsor page, which helps me do this. So I want to thank all the people who are already supporting me, which is mainly Symbiotic UDA, where I did my internship on this project, and also these other kind people. So I will be talking, well, first about some background about how an FPGA actually works on the inside. A bit about the open source tools that are there that we'll be working with, and then about documenting these FPGAs through fuzzing and decoding, and why I say documenting here and not reverse engineering, and then some results. So an FPGA, well, programming logic devices in general, you start with some hardware description language generally, mostly VHDL and Verilog. And then you do synthesis, which goes through to a netlist of logic blocks, such as AND and OR gates and other things, and flip-flops, which are sort of the memory, the state of the program. And the way this is implemented then on the FPGA is through lookup tables and multiplexers, where a lookup table is basically a piece of memory that stores the truth table of a certain logic operations, and then there's this flip-flop for the memory and multiplexers, which are used to route these connections to neighboring tiles, because inside the FPGA are sort of, you know, a whole grid of similar tiles with some exceptions for special purpose blocks for DSP and memory and those kind of things, but the core is really like logic tiles, which are generally a collection of lookup tables and flip-flops, which are called together a slice. And then there is these routing multiplexers that connect various in outputs together. And the way they connect is by intertile wires mostly. So this tile has connections to 1, 2, 4, 8 tiles in any direction neighboring to it, and you can connect anything to anything almost. Like, it's not anything, everything to everything. You try to kind of optimize how much you can connect, because yeah, if you would connect everything to everything, it's a lot of multiplexers and it would take a lot of area. And already these multiplexers take off the majority of the slices, so the FPGA designers really try to optimize how much multiplexers they can get away with. So you also generally see that the more advanced FPGAs have actually less multiplexers because they have better software. So let's take a look now at the software that you generally, how the process works from VHDL to the bits to which you load on your FPGA. And of course, the first step is the programming language. And then there's these synthesis tools, like, well, for the commercial ones, it's Quartus, Vivado, ISE, and then the open source ones. The popular one is like the Yosys, which uses ABC for optimizations. And then this outputs a netlist in various formats that are supported by the tools. And then there's a place and route step where you map these logic elements to a specific location on the FPGA and connect them. And in open source tools, this is sort of separate, where you have this, you take the sort of assembly language of the FPGA and generate it to an actual bitstream. But in the commercial tools, this is generally one step where you just input your netlist and you get a bitstream out. So this is kind of the things that need to happen if you want to have an open source tool flow for your FPGA. So yeah, the first step is synthesis, which is in this case Yosys. And this is, well, it's work, but it's just, you know, software. You know, you can open the documentation from the vendor and you see all their primitives, and you write synthesis for them and it works. Like, there's no digging involved into the software really, or like figuring, yeah. It's just, I don't want to get too much into it, but it's, you know, yeah, a work, but just writing software. And but for place and route, the vendors generally don't really tell you how exactly the FPGAs work inside, so it's a little bit more difficult. And that's why you'll see that Yosys has support for a ton of FPGAs and also other things like ASIC. So they also support Xilinx, Altera, a lot of FPGAs. Well, NextPNR is much harder, so they started with Claire Wolf and the IceStorm project for the ICE40 FPGAs, which then got expanded to the ETP5 FPGAs, also of Lattice. And these are the two main architectures currently supported by NextPNR. But there's work going on to expand this to, well, Gowin in my case, and some other projects that are also working on this. But what NextPNR does not do is generate the actual bitstream. So we need this extra step where you take sort of the assembly language from NextPNR and turn it into an actual bitstream that you can program to your FPGA. And what this talk is mainly about is figuring out the bits you need to do the NextPNR bit, where you place and route all these multiplexers and lookup tables and flip-flops that are inside this FPGA. So to get started, step one, get the license. This is an unfortunate part of commercial FPGA development, is that you have to get the commercial software, and this can vary how it works, but for Gowin you have to fill in this form, and it can be a slow process, and it, from what I've heard, it's preventing some people from using it, for example, in university when you have your whole classroom wanting to work on FPGAs and you have to, you know, wait a week for your license to arrive. It's not a very nice process. So this is also where open source can be really advantageous. Next step is, of course, get an FPGA, or maybe, yeah, depends on, maybe you have one already, but the nice thing about Gowin is SIPID released this really, really, really cheap FPGA board, so, you know, you can just spend $5 and you have an FPGA. This is second, because you don't immediately need it. The first part is just, you know, getting the software, because only once you get your software working can you actually use the FPGA. And then actually install the software, which is also not trivial in some cases, because there's software for Linux, software for Windows, Linux, but in reality Linux in the EDA industry means Red Hat Enterprise Linux. So if you are on Ubuntu or Arch Linux or whatever you have, you are probably out of luck. So that's why I wrote, if software says no, delete that SL, because they ship is fairly old, like C++ standard library files that don't work on modern Linux. So you just delete it from the bundle, then that uses your system library and it generally kind of works. And then the first step is really boring, just read the manual to try to use it as it's supposed to be used and try to get as much information from it as you can. Because like everything that's already there, you don't need to, you know, document it yourself. So it's really a time saver. Spend some time here, basically. The goal of this step is basically to find a way to take the lowest level input that you can generate and automate it, and then get as much information as the generated report as you can. And for going, this means they have a TCL shell, which you can write scripts to input netlist, Verilog, whatever, and then synthesis in place and root it. Their synthesis tool produces a Verilog netlist. So, and then, yeah, so the lowest level you can go in this particular tool is place and root this netlist and then constrain every single cell you put into it to be in a specific location, so you have sort of a deterministic output. And, well, the positive side of this particular FPGA is that their bitstream output that goes into the programmer is an ASCII format, so, I mean, it's not human, like, human readable, it's still like binary, it's really weird, but it's sort of the framing is already done for you, so you don't need to sort of look in the hex editor. The downside of this particular tool is that the other outputs are kind of useless. So yeah, there's not much info on timing or routing or anything that you could like extract useful information from. We'll get to that later also. Now on to fuzzing. Fuzzing on an FPGA basically means you generate a bit stream, you change the tiniest bit of information configuration about this bit stream, generate another one, and then you compare them, and then you know, okay, this minimal change that I made resulted in this one bit flip or whatever, and then you can sort of start to make these connections, what the meaning of all these bits are. And then you repeat it and repeat it and repeat it. So that's the basic idea. So the step one is you write a netlist, and here I wrote this Verilog netlist that the Gowan IDE uses. It has the module and then this LUT4 primitive, which is a lookup table with four inputs, which is what Gowan uses. It's a LUT4 architecture. And then it has a 16-bit, so 2 to the 4th, sort of memory where you put the truth table in, which is this parameter that you can tweak. And then you just, you know, you write it to a file, and you... So in the beginning, I just read this really stupid sort of bash script system, where you can just, you know, you run set on the file to replace this init parameter with an actual value. And you just loop all the combinations and see which bit changes or something. And the other thing you need is a constraint file, because you want to place this LUT in one particular location, so you know, okay, that this location corresponds to these bits in the bitstream. And then you also update this location to whatever you want it to be, because you want to, in the end, you want to, you know, find all the bits, of course. Then you make a TCL script that reads all these files, runs the PNR, you get your bitstream and whatever else output you want. And then you look at the bitstream and see if you can make sense of anything. As I said, for Gowan it's, well, relatively easy, because they have this ASCII grid of bits. So there's this header which is just like fairly constant. I just ignored it and copy-pasted it for myself in the beginning. There's some checksums in there, but yeah. And then there's this giant block of bits that are just like, yeah, they get mapped to the FPGA. You see to the left, there is some bit of padding, and then it starts with the actual bits. And then I found, or actually someone else found that had looked at this before me, that at the end this has a CRC check to ensure it is transmitted correctly, and then there's more padding at the end. And then there's a footer, which I left off here. It's worth noting that for the more bigger FPGAs, I've heard it's more like a command stream, so it's not as easy to change one bit and see the resulting bit, because once you start moving stuff around, the command stream also changes, so you need to dig some deeper to understand this command stream before you can actually map bits to each other. But that's the basic idea, and this for Go was relatively easy. Which I also said in the beginning, it depends on the FPGA. Like, there's no one guide you can write, like, do these steps and you end up with a free open source toolchain. It's a lot of discovery and trial and error. I wrote this little Python script that takes these bit streams and makes a nice image out of them, it makes an image out of them. Where here you can see all these little lookup tables. These are the squares with the flip-flop next to them. From there, this was like basically a big NumPy array. And then you can just XOR two bit streams and you get the difference bits, which is how I sort of figured out the differences. Congratulations, this was your first fizzing of a bit. Yay, only a million more to go. And this is kind of a problem. So this each PNR run like takes a couple of seconds, up to a minute, depending what you're doing, or even longer if you're not constraining everything, of course. So if you can imagine, this FPGA grid is like a lot of bits, millions maybe less. This is a relatively small FPGA. So if you take a minute per bit, you will be there a while. Even if you have this beefy computer, multi-core, it'll be slow. So you need to be a bit more smart about it to make some real progress. I mean, with this you can already do some fun things. Like, you can, for example, tell the vendor tool to generate a bit stream. And then you just can see, okay, this was an AND gate, and now I make it an OR gate by just manually flipping some bits. And then you can test it on your FPGA and see if it works. But if you want to get really something practical, you of course need to understand a lot more bits. And to make this more practical, there is the binary trick. It doesn't have really a name or anything. but the idea is, so imagine you have, I don't know, these little bits. There were 16, but here's like 8 to fit on the slide. 8 bits that you want to find a location of. Normally you would, flip one bit to run to another bit, blah, blah, very slow. It would be 8 runs in this case. But what you can also do is, in each run, sort of assign a binary number to each bit, and then flip them according to this binary number. So you can see A is off in all runs, and then B is like 1, and then C is 2, and D is 3. And this way you can only like log 2 runs for a number of bits, which is of course much more efficient. The problem with this approach is not all combinations are unique. For example, there are bits that you're not testing which will always be null, like 0 all the time. So these will not show up if you're testing A here. And the other, there's also some bits that are always on no matter what you're doing. And in this case, H is also 1 all the time. So that's a bit of a problem. The other problem is that some bits have weird combinations of relations to single feature you're tweaking. So it might not be always a one-to-one relation to the thing you are tweaking in your code and the thing that shows up in your bitstream. So in this case, a simple example is B or C, which conflicts now with D. So you wouldn't be able to tell D apart from A and B and C. That's a bit of a problem. For example, this shows up in I/O banks. Like, every side of the FPGA has an I/O bank which can turn on and off. So if you're using any input output buffer, any pin on any side, it enables this whole bank. if you use this binary trick, this bank will always be on basically, and you will never figure out what this bank bits are. So you need to be slightly more advanced, which is the balanced constant weight code, which is sort of a Hamming distance related thing. But the simple explanation of this is that for each number, the number of 1 and 0 bits is always the same. So in this case, there's always 2 zeros and 3 ones in each number. And you can only imagine that then if you have the AND of two of these numbers, or the OR, it will have more than 3 or less than 3 ones in it. So already, you don't have a number with all zeros or ones, but also logical combinations. There's some technical term for this, but most logical combinations will have also a unique code to them so that they don't conflict with your other bits that you're testing. This is always unique, but it takes a bit more runs than the binary trick, which is a fair trade-off, I think. I'm not exactly sure what the complexity of this one is, but it's still better than, you know, straight one-bit runs. The only problem is, so imagine you are now fuzzing these input-output buffers. You're going through all of them, but you're always like enabling one of them, for example. And this would mean you never see the bank going off. So you need what we call meta fuzzers. They like sort of a collection of other fuzzers, basically. So you add extra runs that deliberately trigger these more complex relations. So you have to sort of, you can write a check. So, okay, I found a combination that I don't understand. For example, the AND of two bits. And then you can give an error, and then you are like, okay, what is this? And then you can find a hypothesis and write a meta fuzzer that says, okay, I expect this bit to be the AND and OR of these other bits. So I expect them to have this pattern. And then you have this meta fuzzer that specifically triggers this pattern so that you turn on these combinations of bits in more complex relations. And this you also do with these constant weight codes, but there's only one here, so you don't see that. But that's meta fuzzers, they are kind of tricky. So that's an overview of fuzzing. A roadblock that I ran into with Gowin is that there's no control or insight into routing. From what I've heard from like ICE40, ECP5, other FPGAs, usually you can either control where you want the wire to go, or at least you can like inspect which routes the vendor tools choose. And either way, you can then sort of correlate these things. But it appears, as far as I know, that Gowin doesn't offer this kind of control. So this makes it almost impossible to fuzz the routing, because you can't change a simple thing. You can't have a minimal change that sort of changes the wire it uses. You just have to sort of rely on the router to pick a different one and sort of push it a bit in the right direction, which is really a pain. So the solution is to also look at the files provided by the vendor. So this vendor has this tool, and of course they also have data files that describe their FPGA. Their binary files, not documented at all. The favorable thing for Gowin IDE is that it doesn't have an end user license agreement, like most of the Xilinx Altera kind of tools that prohibit you from messing with them. So I'm not legally saying anything about this, but this makes it quite like a kind of okay maybe to have a peek at them. I complemented this fuzzing with looking at the files the vendor provided. So basically the goal was to reverse engineer this file structure and write a parser for it so you can extract the data from it. You can do this in several ways. You can just stare at the hex dump and try to make sense of it. And my internship supervisor actually was like a superstar at this, who could just like stare at this hack dump and see immediately all sort of things. I was like, how did you do this? But I'm not such a superstar at this, so I kind of went for other approaches. First is to run the program in GDB. You can just like set breakpoints on things and see if you can extract some information from the memory in the program. And also you can decompile the program and look at the assembly in something like Vitra. I don't know how you say this. So for example, on GDB, one thing I did was, okay, you run a TCL shell, let it start up so you don't get all the startup noise. Then set a breakpoint up on the fopen call. Continue, run the place and route, and then you know continue a few times, and eventually you find this interesting function call where it reads the route data table. So there's some debugging information left in this library, which is convenient, and it points to this data file of the Goin IDE. So I open the Vitra and look at this root node table class, and turns out that it reads this file like straight into a struct, no encoding, no decoding, just struct and to disk and struct from disk. But it had all these getter and setter methods that are like exported as symbols, so I could just like take the setter name and the address it was pointing at, and this would directly correspond to data in this data file. It was a bit laborious going like through the data file, getting all the setters and make it into a little Python script. But in the end, you get a Python script that can extract these things and at least have some names to them. The other fun thing I did was sort of write automated GDB scripts. Like normally you use GDB like interactively typing into it, but you can also just tell it to load scripts, and this script in particular breaks another function that reads another type of data file. And then it breaks at every read out of this file and tells you the offset into the file and how much bytes were written and the function they were written from. So you can sort of correspond these functions to their addresses and blah 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 blah. And then this particular file was more of like an archive with tables and different things in it, more of like an actual file structure that was a bit more involved. But then you write a parser for it and you can extract this data. Unfortunately, data is not equal to meaning, so you have this bunch of binary numbers and you don't know what's going on. And they also did some interesting techniques where they encoded data as like decimal digits of a binary number. Interesting. But okay, you can look at this data and you have some names from the exported symbols. The simple ones are like the LUT bits. They're just, you know, bit one is this bit. A bigger challenge was routing, which was the key thing that I wanted to do this for. This in the end, I managed to figure out and extract the routing information from this FSE file, but it wasn't completely brilliant solution. But for example, the IO buffers, they tend to be very complex in FPGAs. They do a lot of different voltage levels, different modes, different everything. And then I started making sense of all these random fuses and things. And then it turns out they're also different per FPGA. And I was like, oh my god, okay, this doesn't make any sense. So then I went back to fuzzing. The nice thing is, once you have the fuzzing or the chip data, the fuzzing becomes a lot easier because you kind of know what you're looking at. So you have this, from this data files, you can sort of extract the tiles and you know, okay, all these tiles are of the same type and you know their boundaries and their size. So you don't need to duplicate all the fuzzing work for each and every tile. You can sort of fuzz each tile separately. So this leads to some simplification and speed up where you can fuzz per tile, basically per tile type. So yeah, in this case, the look bits and the basic routing was from the vendor data directly, no fuzzing involved. But the IOB and data flip-flops are fuzzed, basically. So what I did in this case, this was like my third fuzzer with first, you know, the bash script, then I did the binary tricks, and then I had this tiled fuzzer after the fuzz, after the chip debate decoding. And what I did here is, yeah, you take like, you know, okay, you have all the modes that you want your flip-flop to be in, for example. So you say, okay, I have tiled type 12. For each flip-flop type, put one in every tile, first like run the PNR, and then you extract, you know, you go back to the tiles and see all the different modes that this particular flip-flop can be in. So you do this per tile tab and you can go much faster, you don't have to do all these binary tricks. What you do have to do is logic for combining as much different fuzzers into as little worms as possible to optimize for speed. This can be quite confusing and complicated, and I think the limiting factor here was the output buffers, because as you can see in the middle, there's a few that are only like a specific type. So you need, you know, you need all the types of IOBs that you want at this particular tile type. You need to do it for this tile type, and there's only one of them, so it's kind of slow. But it's still more efficient than all these binary tricks, because you only have to do it once per tile type, basically. The hard part was the clock filter. So I didn't talk to Miss too much about this yet, but in an FPGA you have like the intertile routing, which is like these wires to neighboring tiles. But there's also like global routing, which are generally used for clock trees and resets and other like high fan out signals that you want across your whole FPGA. In the Go in, there's like 8 of them. And well, yeah. Their muxes are in the ChipDB, so in this sense you have the basic data. But like, okay, so for the intertile routing, their names are kind of obvious. It's like, you know, there's like north, two tiles, number 3. So it's the third wire. You know, sort of like the information is encoded in the name. For the clock router, it's not. Like, it's very irregular also. If you see here, like these horizontal lines are spines. They go from the center tile where every global signals comes in from the PLL and the input pins. And then they sort of spread out across this spine column. And in each spine column, there is one multiplexer that connects it to a tap, which is just like a vertical running wire. But there's only one tap per column. So you have to kind of figure out which column is connected to which spine, basically. And you can see here sort of like 1, 2, 3, 4, 1, 2, 3, 4, 1, 2, 3, 4. But you don't know that, so you have to write fuzzers that are basically take up the whole FPGA, where you sort of scan flip-flops across rows to see which spine they get connected to. And also this local like horizontal branches, they're called. They spread out a few tiles from this tap, but it's also kind of irregular how far they spread and which tap they connect to. So again, this fuzzer has to sort of sweep flip-flops across in several hundreds of runs to see which row connect to which branch and then to which tap and which spine. And in this picture I drew like the 4 primary ones, and there's also 4 secondary ones, and it's a big mess. So this was some recent work that I did that to improve the global clock routing, and I'm now working on this next PNR part to incorporate that. And yeah, after you've done all this fuzzing on the tile decoding, you can sort of figure out the tile format, and you can see here at the bottom 8 rows or what? 4 maybe? Yeah, I think 4 actually. Well, a few rows. There's like the LUTs and the flip-flops. And then everything above it is just multiplexers. It's like, you know, 80% multiplexers. Which is, I mean, like, even if you knew that there's a lot of multiplexers, this was just kind of still like a wow, shocking moment to see how much it is. Yeah, this is just a picture I generated from this Fuse file where you just color everything differently and the manually wrote the labels on top of them. Pretty picture, not that insightful. Yeah, then you can start to generate these placements and routing for the stuff that you decoded. And you have your fully open source FPGA toolchain. This particular one is running a RISC-V core that is calculating primes, and it's running on this Go-in board of Trans Electronics that's also laying behind me here. And yeah, that's my story. And this is Project Apicula, and it's on GitHub. You can check it out, contribute, start your own FPGA reversing engineering project, or join some other one. Or, well, I hope you enjoyed it, and thank you for listening. And I think there will be a Q&A after this.
So this concludes the talk. Thanks very, very much, Pepin. Very, very interesting. And of course, there's questions. One question that comes from the IRC channel is, does the GoWin software provide a simulator for which useful data like timing or so could be extracted by just observing the simulation process?
Yeah, so thank you. They do not provide their whole simulator. They do provide timing file, like they provide behavioral models for Verilog. So you can take your Verilog models from them and simulate it, but that's behavioral simulation. It doesn't include timing data. There are some encrypted models somewhere floating around, I think, but there's of course encrypted, so you can't easily extract timing data from them. So then it's easier to just decode the timing database that they also have.
All right. So because I didn't see another question, thanks again for your great talk. I see that you have a talk right now as well on the same channel. And thanks again for the people who still want to ask questions to Pepin. Just go to the RC3 Chaos Zone channel and ask your questions right away. And yeah, Pepin will try to answer them as well. Thanks again, and see you soon. Bye-bye.